Mayor Lightfoot returns questionable campaign contributions. And I'll talk with Crane's reporter Ali Marotti about retail, what Chicagoans can expect to spend this holiday season, the industry trend of pop-up shops, and more.
The shop and the shop concept is one that we're familiar with because of Ulta doing it with Target. So that's what Claire's is starting to do with Macy's.
I'm Amy Guth, and this is Crane's Daily Gist for Tuesday, December 6th. At Wintrust Community Banks, you're more than just another account number. No matter your stage of life, Wintrust's dependable bankers are as dedicated to your financial success as you are. After three decades of serving communities across Chicagoland, Wintrust has built its reputation on exceptional customer satisfaction and a strong local presence. That's why Wintrust is proud to be ranked number one in customer satisfaction in retail banking in Illinois by J.D. Power. Visit Wintrust.com/JD Power to learn more about Wintrust's award-winning banking experience. Members FDIC. For J.D. Power 2022 award information, visit JDPower.com/awards. I'm joined by Crane's reporter Ali Marotti here to talk retail. So, of course, this time of year, we are very closely looking at how things are shaking out for retailers or watching consumer spending as an economic indicator. So there's lots of retail things to discuss today. You did some in-depth reporting on kind of what the average Chicagoan is likely to spend this holiday season. Tell me about that.
So the average Chicagoan is expected to spend about $719 on their holiday shopping, and that includes travel, gifts, you know, food purchases, etc. Now, that's lower than the national average of $770, which I think reflects a little bit of the, you know, Midwestern mindfulness, you might say.
Sure.
But it's up almost 20% from last year's spend, and that is because consumers are realizing that they're going to have to spend more because of inflation.
So over the past couple of years, there were supply chain issues that were impacting retail. Are we dealing with any of that this year, or is that for the most part pretty resolved?
There are some of those issues remaining, but I am told this data that I got is from Accenture, and they tell me that supplies and inventory are higher than what they were in previous years. And that's positive for these retailers, obviously. And that's one of the reasons why you started seeing, you know, your holiday deals, your Black Friday deals, or whatever they were calling them, start earlier this year. Some were going as early as Halloween. Part of it was to get some of this inventory pushed through, because though they have inventory, it might not be the right inventory. So, you know, these retailers are really having to, I don't know, play sort of this complicated chess game as they figure out, how do we get consumers to come in and spend their money even though they're pinching their pennies? How do we meet them at just the right time for that and just the way that they want to, right? So thinking about kind of the online purchases, the buy online, pick up in store, which has gotten very popular since the pandemic started, you know, all those different puzzle pieces that go into trying to make sure you can capture these consumers.
And I know Q4 is always such a big part of any retailer's bottom line, but what local retailers in the big national brands that are based locally, who are you keeping an eye on in terms of maybe someone that struggled throughout the year that's really kind of counting on Q4 to make their books or something like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the big retailers that I watch is Ulta. You know, they're based out in Bolingbrook, and they, you know, have had a pretty good year, actually. Not looking for them to come out of a slump or anything, but they're an interesting turnaround story because they were in a really deep slump during the pandemic, right? You know, nobody was wearing makeup, nobody was going out. People were buying skincare products and those sort of pampering type products, but it was a rough go. They also got a new CEO about a year and a half ago, so I was keeping an eye on him, and I will continue to do that. And Ulta actually just posted their highest stock price ever the other day, which is very interesting. And I think sort of shows, you know, the beauty industry is seeing a bit of a rebound because people are out and about again. This is the first holiday season where we're not going to have super strict lockdowns. You know, last year, if you recall, the Omicron variant was hitting right around the holidays. So I think a lot of people bailed on holiday plans at the last minute. And Ulta is benefiting from that. The other thing that's going on with them I find fascinating is that because they have sort of, you know, these different tiers of the brands that they sell, they've got prestige, but they've also got mass beauty, which basically just means you're more expensive versus your cheaper options. You know, they are insulated a little bit from the consumer behavior that might, you know, buy the cheaper option to try to save money. So they've got that going for them. They're all based in the US. They don't have any international locations, which is sheltering them from, you know, some of the upheaval going on in China right now, potential supply chain stuff. You know, they've got a lot of good things going for them right now. And I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with them this quarter. They had a really big Black Friday sale too that did well despite some technical difficulties at the beginning of the sale. And they're kind of a bellwether in how are consumers behaving. Are they buying all their deals online? Are they going in to the store? And, you know, some analysts looked at them on Black Friday, went into their stores and was sort of like, okay, I see some sellouts going on in the makeup section, in the fragrance section, even though there's no sales going on in the fragrance section. So those sorts of kind of tells that they're watching. And it seems like Ulta is doing well. And like I said, a lot of it's because the industry at large is doing well. So there's, you know, there's retailers like that that we can kind of watch and get an idea of what's going on a broader scale.
I think Ulta is so interesting because earlier in the pandemic, it was maybe early 2021, maybe even before that, maybe even late 2020, you and I were talking about the impact on lipstick sales as people were masking. And of course that happened, but it was sort of an interesting thing to see hitting Ulta and hitting their bottom line because like masks were happening. We weren't wearing a lot of makeup. If we did, it was just a little bit of eye makeup.
It was so interesting to listen to the earnings calls because the executives would say, you know, the above the mask makeup is doing well. And so you're like, all right, cool. The eyeshadow, the mascara, all that kind of stuff.
The concealer.
Another thing that they've tried really hard to do over the past couple of years is lean into kind of the pampering type products, the skincares, the bath bombs, you know, the fragrances, that sort of thing, because they want beauty to be not necessarily about how you look, but how you feel. Because if it's something that's going to make you feel good, it's something that you're not going to cut back on during a time, like a recessionary time, like we're in right now. Historically, the beauty category has been pretty strong throughout, you know, recessionary times. And it's just because people consider it not so much a thing that they want to cut out, right? It's something that they want, something that they want to keep buying. Maybe they'll buy a cheaper option or whatever. But they're not going to stop wearing makeup. And that's something that Ulta has really tried to lean into over the past few years, as people did, in fact, stop wearing makeup. So I think it'll be interesting to see how that pays off, you know, over the next few months, depending on what happens with the economy.
Yeah. The other thing I think is interesting about Ulta in particular is that their brick and mortar versus e-commerce play is so different because it's such an experiential thing in their stores. They've always encouraged, you know, sample this, try this on. They've got mirrors and little counters everywhere because they've always encouraged people to kind of play with the makeup.
Totally.
So I think that's a little bit different feeling than say walking into like a clothing store or something, you know, where you're like, okay, I'll just order that online. Their in-person experience is a little bit different than a lot of retailers.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And that's something that they have going for them. When I talk to experts about Ulta, they always talk about how, you know, that is a perk of Ulta. That is something that is going to set them apart. You know, right now you can't buy some of these brands on Amazon. You know, if one day that happens, what Ulta will still have over Amazon are those services, you know, and they've translated a lot of that to online as well to really try to get that, you know, in the industry jargon, they call it omni-channel, where it's your online shopping and your in-person shopping. They've also been opening up all these shops and shops within Target locations to try to just rope in more people. But you're exactly right. I mean, you can go onto their website and you can try on different lipsticks virtually, or you can go in and do that in person. You know, they just started rolling out, I believe it was ear piercing is sort of a new service they have in there. They've got most of their services in store back up and running again from the pandemic. And it's something that they're leaning into. And, you know, that's something where you see their new CEO, Dave Kimball. His background is sort of in merchandising and marketing. And you can see that come through there, especially with, you know, how are we driving people online and in store? he told me a stat. I spoke with him recently about how many people, I can't remember it off the top of my head, but how many people where if you're shopping in an Ulta store, you're also shopping online at Ulta. So they're kind of a unicorn in that way, right? It's not just, oh, this person happened to walk by an Ulta store and pop in. Most of their sales come through their loyalty program. And, you know, I think that's something that's going to pay off for them, especially now. They've got all this data on their consumers. And again, Dave Kimball's marketing background comes in handy here, but they're really leaning into these personalized promotions. So instead of here's a $5 off coupon on a product you may or may not buy, really like here's this brand that you bought previously in this color eyeshadow or whatever. And, you know, please come in and buy that again. So that's something that we're seeing a lot of retailers do recently. It's something we're all familiar with getting at the grocery store, for example. You buy Oreos all the time. Here's, you know, whatever, 10% off coupon for your next Oreo purchase. But we're seeing that come into the retail world a lot more. And it seems like Ulta is leading the way there.
And that makes perfect sense because we just spent 2 years mostly shopping online or shopping online a lot more, accelerating our use of e-commerce. Of course, retailers have a lot more information about us and our habits.
The big what if is, will these retailers capitalize on all that data they have? And you're starting to see Ulta do that for sure.
So you mentioned pop-ups and ear piercing, which leads me to, you've also done some reporting about how Claire's is partnering with Macy's to open some shops within a shop there. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So these topics have really nice segues because the shop in the shop concept is one that we're familiar with because of Ulta doing it with Target.
Yeah.
And more and more retailers are starting to do this. It's a really interesting concept where if you think about walking into the main store, the Target that I go to over on Elston has one of the Ultas inside of it. And you walk in and it has, it's like a mini Ulta store in there. You know, it's not just Ulta's products on the shelves. So that's what Claire's is starting to do with Macy's. They've opened 20, you know, around the country, including one out at the Macy's in Oak Brook Center. That's the only one in the Chicago area right now. And Macy's is a really interesting retailer. They're based out in Hoffman Estates. And what they're trying to do is get away from being a mall-based retailer. I grew up in the 90s. So, you know, I was used to going there and buying my earrings or whatever the accessory might be. They're trying to get away from that. And doing these shop in a shop is one way for them to do that and kind of diversify not just their real estate base, but their consumer base as well.
Yeah. Did you get your ears pierced at Claire's?
I did not. I got my ears pierced when I was, I think, 5 at just a generic store in a mall about 45 minutes from my house. My grandma took me.
It's a rite of passage, like the guns at Claire's. It's a whole thing.
Oh, totally. I mean, how many people do you think you witnessed getting their ears pierced at Claire's?
Because also that.
Dozens, at yeah. least.
Because once you have your ears pierced, then you go in there and you see this like a younger girl like cringing about to get the
yes. Like,
oh, I feel for you, sister. I've been there.
I know. And you know, that's interesting because they've continued to kind of keep that ear piercing prowess that they have. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something that they're trying to do, you know, in other places. I think they do it in Walmarts now. They already have shops and shops in about 360 Walmarts around the country, which I personally did not know that. You know, I thought that was interesting. But on top of that, they've got all these really interesting merchandising partnerships where, you know, their items are sold at different retailers. I mean, Walmart is one of them. There are a bunch of others that they work with as well. So you can really see them kind of leaning into the things that they do best without just having that single, like, you know, standalone shop within a brick and mortar mall. So it'll be interesting to see what happens and how, you know, how this Macy's thing plays out. Macy's, for their part, has been doing this as well. The one downtown in the Loop on State Street just opened a Toys R Us up on the 5th floor. So you can kind of see how all these different retailers and department stores that maybe lost a little bit of relevance at some point along the way, whether it was because of just the mall real estate situation or the department stores kind of losing some of their sales figures to online stuff, they're trying to innovate.
You know, this ongoing conversation we've been having about retail vacancy rates and how more and more retailers are saying, I don't think I need this giant space anymore. I do need something, but I don't need that. This pop-up idea is so interesting because it starts to blend a lot of retail concepts together.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fascinating to see. And, you know, with the Ulta and Target one, it's a really interesting revenue model that they use there. You know, it's the Target employees. So it's really low cost for Ulta to have that in there. I'm not exactly sure what the revenue model looks like for Claire's and Macy's, but it's just very fascinating to see how these companies structure these deals and what their priorities are. And for Ulta, they're happy with it. They say it's about winning new customers and that it's paying off for them. And Target, you know, their executives rave about it on their earnings calls. So I'll definitely be watching for how this Claire's situation plays out in Macy's.
Definitely. Well, lots of retail things to watch this time of year, but I appreciate you swinging by to talk it through. Thanks so much, Ellie.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Coming up, Crane's political columnist Greg Hines says Garcia faces crypto questions in the Chicago mayoral race. We'll talk about that and more right after this.
The Greater Chicago Food Depository is working to help communities facing an elevated need right now. Decades-high inflation is making it even harder for our neighbors to afford groceries, and food insecurity is above pre-pandemic levels. Children are at greatest risk, with one in four facing hunger. Let's rise to the challenge, Chicago. Your neighbor is hungry. Give what you can to the Greater Chicago Food Depository at chicagosfoodbank.org.
This is the Crane's Daily Gist with Amy Guth.
Mayor Lori Lightfoot is returning a series of campaign contributions from entities affiliated with a business owner after a news report raised questions about whether they violated the city's complex campaign finance rules. A Chicago Sun-Times story published on Friday morning detailed tens of thousands of dollars in donations to the mayor from companies tied to Carmen Rossi, who owns several Chicago bars and restaurants, the liquor license for Lollapalooza, and has a stake in a parking company that holds a contract with Chicago Public Schools. Until Tuesday, he was also a registered lobbyist with the city. Crane's government reporter Justin Lawrence noted that a spokesperson for Lightfoot's campaign said it's giving back about $42,000 in contributions to various Rossi-affiliated entities at their request. Lawrence reported that the spokesperson said, quote, "Our team executes a rigorous vetting process on every contribution with all campaign finance rules and laws," continuing by saying, "To avoid even an appearance or implication of an issue, we are complying with a request that contributions related to the businesses in question be returned." Also saying, quote, "It is our understanding that those contributions will be donated to charity." An executive order issued by former Mayor Rahm Emanuel and continued under Lightfoot prohibits campaign contributions by registered lobbyists. Another rule limits those who contract with the city or with sister agencies such as the school district or park district from contributing more than $1,500 to any Chicago elected official or candidate during a single year. Lawrence noted that rather than personally contributing to Lightfoot in his own name, Rossi contributed to the mayor through entities tied to his hospitality and real estate interests, making it unclear if the donations were appropriate under the executive order. Lawrence also noted that a spokesperson for Rossi told Crane's that his lobbying engagements have, quote, "all closed," also saying, quote, "While we believe these contributions are appropriate, at his request, those companies have asked that they be refunded in order to avoid any suggestion of impropriety." The spokesperson's statement also said, quote, "Once those contributions are refunded, 100% of those funds will be donated to charity." United Airlines is reportedly in late-stage talks with Boeing and Airbus as the carrier considers narrow and wide-body models for potentially significant orders to bolster its fleet. Bloomberg reported, citing people familiar with the matter, that Chicago-based United is looking at taking more than 100 Boeing 787 Dreamliners as part of a triple-digit twin-aisle order that CEO Scott Kirby has touted to pilots. Bloomberg also reported that United may also convert an earlier order for Airbus's A350 wide-body jets to its longest narrow-body model, the A321neo. Back in October, Bloomberg reported that the potential multi-billion-dollar deals would cap a months-long process as United worked to wrap up talks with Boeing and Airbus before year's end. The Wall Street Journal reported Friday about the potential deal, sending Boeing's shares up by 4%. United has about 128 twin-aisle Boeing jets that are at least two decades old on average, that according to Cirium data. and that's an age where maintenance costs generally steeply increase on planes. The report also said that the airline is expected to load up on Boeing's smallest Dreamliner model, the 787-8, as a replacement for its 767 fleet. Advocate Aurora Health, Chicago's largest healthcare provider, said it has completed a deal to merge with Charlotte-based Atrium Health in a deal that creates the fifth largest nonprofit health system in the country. Crain's healthcare reporter Catherine Davis, citing a statement from the hospital organization, reported that the combined entity is named Advocate Health and will serve nearly 6 million patients annually across 1,000 sites of care and 67 hospitals. Combined, they generate revenue topping $27 million. The merger also moves Advocate Aurora Health's headquarters from the Midwest to Charlotte. Advocate Aurora CEO Jim Skogsberg and Atrium CEO Eugene Woods will serve as co-CEOs for the first 18 months, after which Skogsberg intends to retire. While Advocate Health will be based in Charlotte, Skogsberg previously told Crain's that Advocate Aurora will maintain a strong organizational presence in Chicago and Milwaukee, and has plans to expand with a new institute for health equity in Milwaukee. Skogsberg also previously said that none of Advocate Aurora's workers will be relocated to Charlotte. Wake Forest University School of Medicine in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, will be Advocate Health's affiliated academic institution. The Advocate Healthcare, Atrium Health, and Aurora Healthcare brands will continue to be used in the areas they serve. Combined, the system employs more than 21,000 physicians and nearly 42,000 nurses, and provides nearly $5 billion in what was described as community benefit each year. Davis noted that the merger was closely examined by state regulators. In Illinois, the state's Hospital Oversight Committee initially voted against Advocate Aurora's change of ownership exemptions before reconsidering and giving Advocate Aurora more time to provide information about the merger. About a month later, the Illinois Health Facilities and Services Review Board approved the request. Davis also reported that North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein issued a statement saying that after a thorough review of the merger, his office concluded there is no legal basis to prevent it, but did say, quote, "However, I am concerned about this combination's possible effects on healthcare access in rural and urban underserved communities." Davis also noted in reporting that the Advocate Aurora and Atrium merger is just the latest example of hospital chains joining forces across the U.S. Mergers, she noted, allow healthcare providers to grow their footprints quickly and gain power in the healthcare landscape. Davis noted that typically the larger health providers become, the more bargaining power they also have with health insurance providers over reimbursement rates. Crain's political columnist Greg Hines noted that contentious as the collapse of Sam Bankman-Fried's crypto empire has been, also at issue is how Illinois members of Congress and candidates for Congress benefited, apparently asking few, if any, questions while he spent on their behalf. Back in June, Hines reported that Bankman-Fried dropped significant funding into last-minute campaign ads for Jonathan Jackson in the final stages of the race to get him elected, as well as for other candidates. Most recipients were Democrats, but downstate Republican Rodney Davis got some of that funding, too, for his failed re-election bid. Those congressional races are now history, Hines noted, but not the race for mayor of Chicago, where U.S. Representative Jesus Chuy Garcia is running for the job and, as Hines puts it, has $200,000 in crypto baggage to explain. The question, Hines writes, is how and why did the Protect the Future PAC, heavily funded by Bankman-Fried, who gave at least $27 million before his company went under, come to spend almost $200,000 on ads and mailers this spring urging a vote for Garcia in a Democratic congressional primary in which he was unopposed? Also noting Garcia's service on the House Financial Services Committee, which regulates crypto. Hines noted that Garcia has said little on the matter, though Hines said he did speak with a senior advisor to Garcia's mayoral campaign, Manny Diaz, who said that the money from the Protect the Future PAC was, quote, an independent expenditure, over which Garcia legally could have no control or knowledge. He also noted that Bankman-Fried directly donated to many other politicians all over Washington, which is accurate. The Biden Victory Fund got $50,000, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee $250,000, and Illinois Congressional hopeful Gil Villegas $2,900. Hines reported that Diaz also said that Garcia favors appropriate crypto rules and that he's returned a $2,900 personal campaign contribution from Bankman-Fried.
That's Crane's Daily Gist for now. Check in on our continuous news feed at chicagobusiness.com. Thanks so much to today's guest, Crane's reporter, Ali Marotti. You can follow all of our conversations on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to get your audio on demand. Don't forget to subscribe and please rate and review Crane's Daily Gist. Our show is produced by Todd Manley at Earsight Studios. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll meet you right back here next time.